Ladies and gentlemen, it's just coming up to a quarter to, and I think everybody's had certainly had main course and dessert as well, so I think we should start, because I think we're in for possibly a good long evening. The hotel said we've got to be out of here by 11, so I said, well, thanks for that, we'll see how things go. But I wanted to, on behalf of our president, Joan Thompson, and fellow directors of the Nassau Institute, to welcome you here to this event, which, as you know, is to look at the proposed economic partnership agreement with the European Union. At the start, I'd just like to acknowledge the most welcome support we've received from our sponsors this evening, and they are The Luggage Store, CBS Bahamas Limited, Custom Computers, NMC Leasing, and Security in General. We thank them warmly, as indeed we thank all our sponsors over the course of the year, who assist us to do our work as the sole think tank in the Bahamas, and of course, a non-profit organization. Somebody said to me the other day that any time he picked up a newspaper, he saw something about the Nassau Institute. So I said, hooray, that's what we're trying to do. We produce commentaries to the press on a regular basis. We almost invariably, Larry, I see you over there, we almost invariably get published. And I think this particular man was thinking of three things we've done recently, one on education, one on price control, and a commentary on the budget. But I just want to tell people also that we now have premises on East Bay. Some of the people I can see now have been to our discussion groups, which we have from time to time. We advertise this on our website, and we've had some interesting sessions there. We have a conference room. It's called the Milton Friedman Room. He's our guru. He was also Mrs. Thatcher's guru after she retrieved Britain from socialism in the 1980s. And we've done it, we've had permission, and we've had some nice, interesting, lively meetings. And of course, we try to have these dinner events as often as we can. And I think, again, one or two people have come to the one we had from Larry Reed, a session with him from the Mackinac Institute in Michigan. He gave us a very interesting talk on privatization. And we also had Dan Boudreau of George Mason University, who talked about globalization. The purpose, obviously, of these events is to stimulate people and provide a platform, if you like, for interesting subjects which are of concern to the Bahamas. The purpose of this evening was to look at the EPA from the private sector perspective. John Delaney has not come. Unfortunately, he's unwell, but he did say he would come. But he will be glad if I say that the criticism that the government has had for not publicising or not setting out its policy, I'm not altogether sure is justified. There's a lot online you can pick up, a number of publications. They've had a number of town meetings, and, of course, the Chamber of Commerce, College of the Bahamas, Freeport, and so on. But that's not what we're trying to do. What we're trying to do tonight is to discuss this, debate it, and look at it from a private sector's perspective. I want to just explain that we're having a slightly different format this evening. As people normally, as I mentioned, Larry Reed and Dan Boudreau, this time we've got two speakers, and they're both preeminent in their field, in their professional field. So I think it would be almost cheeky of me to try to introduce them. Everybody in this room knows exactly who they are. But for any out-of-towners, and I'm not sure that there are, but if there are any out-of-towners, let me just say that Brian Marie, of course, is a senior partner of the leading law firm McKinney Bancroft, and people will recall that he was also headed up the Bahamas Financial Services Consultative Forum under the last government. He's an expert in this particular field we're talking about, as, of course, is Ray Winder as well. People will also recall, I think, that Ray Winder was deputy chairman of the Trade Commission, And of course, he's now managing partner at Deloitte Touche. What we're going to do is for both Ray and Brian, in that order, are going to make presentations here, and then they will sit down, and we'll have questions from the floor. And I hope that we will have a lively debate. We certainly will hope that that will happen. I was going to recognize John Delaney. He hasn't shown up. I understand he's unwell. But I would like to recognize Simon Wilson, who is Director of Economic Planning in the Ministry of Finance. And I'm sure that he will wish to contribute as appropriate when we get to the question and answer session. So I'll now hand over to Ray to give his presentation.
Thank you, Peter. Ladies and gentlemen, good evening. It's a real pleasure to be in your midst to really talk a little bit about something that I think is very important for us as Bahamians to begin looking at and having some dialogue as to what our thoughts and what our concerns are relative to these types of agreement. I think this is just the beginning in terms of agreements that the Bahamas will have to look at and make a decision as to whether or not they want to participate. And I think the process is just getting started. And I think it's going to, you know, you will be surprised the number of agreements we're going to be looking at in the next 2 to 3 years. So I think it's good that all of us try to begin to understand the process, what's happening, and why we're having to look at these agreements and to begin formulating our minds, you know, what are some of the concerns and what are some of the issues. Now, when Brian and I met the other day for lunch, you know, we talked about, you know, while this is a debate, you know, Brian is a lawyer, and, you know, most of these agreements are written. And so I told Brian, look, let's not focus on that legal detail, Danny. Let's focus on the big picture. But I thought, I said, Brian, you know, I'm going to share my presentation with you. And, you know, so if you have any concerns, you can let me know. So I sent him a copy a couple of days ago. And lo and behold, he shows it the night with a presentation to make also in terms of the chart itself. So, Brian, anyway, you had an opportunity to look at what I have to say. I haven't had an opportunity to look at what you have to say. I think that's not fair trade, right? Anyway, let's go ahead and get started. I'm not going to be the one to say that. Some of the things I want to talk about, I know some of you may have had an opportunity already to participate in some groupings that have had some discussions about this, and so please forgive me if I talk a little bit about some of the things that you may have heard before, but I thought there may be some of you in the room who may not have had an opportunity to get a sense of some of the basic parts of the agreement, and basically what I'm trying to do is just share a little bit off that with you. I'm sure you would appreciate that the agreement itself is a long, drawn-out document, and it's very difficult to be able to summarize all of it. But just with hitting the what I consider to be some of the real points of concerns that you're likely to have in the agreement. Now, there may be others, and hopefully if there are others, I hope Brian would note those, and we can also discuss about them. But I note a couple of them that I think are ones of concern that I think the average citizen would have. So I'm going to talk a little bit about the structure, and then I'm going to talk about how is the service schedule organized, because I think that is one of the area that, you know, the Bahamas trade primarily in services. I think the goods part of this agreement is not as difficult to swallow as the service part. So I think it's important that, you know, we spend a little time with that. How a commitment schedule, you know, how it's done, the discussion, the debate, and so forth. What the EPA means for the Bahamas and some advantages. I'm sure we'll have some debate about that as to whether or not they are real advantages and so on. And some challenges, you know, I thought we would have relative to the agreement itself. The agreement is primarily in four main parts, trade and goods. And those of you who remember the trade and goods portion has been dealt with. That's already been agreed, and now it's the trade and services is the part that we are currently debating and trying to come to some agreement. But this is a part of trade and goods, a chapter on investment, trade and services, and e-commerce, which is basically where most of the concerns. And then there's a chapter on current payments and capital movements. You know, once you have or you've allowed investments to happen within a country, you know, you need some structure as to how capital can move within the framework. Because clearly you don't want a situation where governments restrict the movement of capital, but neither do you want a situation where investors are able to come in and overnight, you know, cause significant balances in the payment movement. So there are some concerns about that, and the agreement talks a little bit about that in terms of how to regulate that to some degree. And then, obviously, you know, when we talk about these trade agreements, especially for the Bahamas, since, you know, as a country, we really haven't been operating in a framework, we are at a disadvantage. There's no question about it. We're the only country in the world that probably is not a part of a major trade agreement, okay? Most countries are a part of at least the WTO. We're not a part of the WTO. I think it would have been an excellent point of reference if we have, the WTO was behind us, because clearly every trade agreement that we begin to talk about will be what we call WTO plus. And what I mean when I say is that no countries that is a member of WTO can enter into a trade agreement with another country where the terms of that agreement are at a lower standard than the WTO. Now, in terms of liberalization, in other words, you can go beyond WTO, but you cannot give less than WTO, because that's the bottom line for all trade agreement. And so this trade agreement is WTO plus. In other words, it does have a little bit more liberalization that you would find in WTO. But as a part of our trade, you need to talk about competition. You know, we don't have a competition policy. And clearly, in this regime, once we enter into any agreement, it would require a competition policy. If we join FTAA, if we join CSME, if we join the WTO, competition policy would have been one of those minimal structural component of operating from a business standpoint that would be a part of a country's regulation. And then obviously, because of all the concerns around innovation and intellectual property rights, and we've heard about all the kinds of issues, you know, in the Bahamas around the concern with what's our favorite, the telecommunications, in terms of being able to bring U.S. movies and films here, and whether or not they have the rights to do it and so on. I mean, there's a whole debate around that, discussions and so forth. Okay, and then there's some social aspects, environment and so on, and protection of personal data. Main issues of trading goods. Basically, all trade agreement, and you know, we'll talk about liberalizing the movement of goods. Now, the question is whether or not, and to what extent, and over what period. Now, the great part about this agreement is that the movement of duties, as we know it, duty. Now, all of you may have heard that the government is in the process of initiating a change in the terminology in terms of what we define as duty, and hopefully to put that out there to see whether or not that will suffice. If it does, fine. If it doesn't, then obviously we're going to have to come up with other means of taxation once we scale back on duties. But the reality of this agreement is that there's a time frame from 0 to 25 years of scaling back duties on goods. 25 years. So we have 25 years to put in place a regime to deal with the movement of duties on goods. I would like to think, and I would like to believe, that at a minimum, the Bahamas should be able, within 25 years, to come up with alternative means to accommodate for that movement. So that's not an unreasonable position, okay? Now, the government has looked at that process. I have identified where we get most of our revenue, and have tried to put those areas where we derive most of our revenue in the latter part of liberalization in terms of the removal of duties, okay? In order for them not to be faced with a situation overnight losing revenue and then having to make up. So they have a transitional period to be able to put in place other means of adjusting for that. Basically, the agreement talks about removing of subsidies, in other words, preventing countries from providing subsidies to countries, their companies exporting to other countries. We know about that, you know, I mean, you talk about Japan has always been a great country of doing that, and restriction, you know, in terms of export goods coming in. So the agreement talks about all kinds of language to prevent countries from putting in place those types of terms at the part of the agreement. Obviously, a big part of this agreement means the improvement of customs. We all know the challenges we have in customs. In fact, most of us as business persons probably have an individual whose job is primarily to go to customs and fill out the forms and so forth, you know. And while we like to talk about the fact that we are moving to a better improvement in terms of the way how business is conducted in this country, let's be real. It hasn't happened. What is happening down at the airport would never have happened if it wasn't privatized. How long has the government been talking about it? 20 years? 25 years? But the reality is, it didn't happen. And it only happened because we put private sector involved. Okay? A big part of this agreement almost forces our government to finally come to the table and deal with some of the basic infrastructure that any country should have relative to rules and regulation in doing business. We all know how business is done in this country. It's all a matter of when, who, and where as to whether something happens. That's not the way business ought to be conducted. Well, guess what? By signing this agreement, our government would be forced to be a little bit more attentive to those types of issues and not leave them merely to a group of men sitting up, to a group of lawyers primarily, sitting around the table making a decision as to whether or not they're going to let this one do the deal or that one do the deal and so on. Their hands would be tied somewhat because now they have other countries they would have to look up to and be have to respond as to why they are changing or not changing. And clearly, once you sign these agreements, you do get sued as a country, you know. And, you know, what's interesting about most of these agreements is that once a country is entered into these agreements, most of the suing of the government happens to be residents suing the government, not foreigners suing the government. Because what has happened now is that there's a fresh air in the system. And now with this whole movement, companies and individuals now feel freer and now have more rights. Because guess what? Their appeal is not to the members of cabinet, they're appealing to some other bodies that the Bahamas has to agree with or has to give an account as to why they're not doing what they're doing. So that's a major part. Let no one fool you. Now, some may say, you know, we shouldn't have to enter into agreement to make it happen. But folks, let's be real. Let's be real. These things, Patelco should have been privatized months, years ago. But guess what? It hasn't happened. Why it hasn't happened? Because all kind of political interference and so forth. And we suffered as a country. And we continue to suffer as a country because our government lacks the will to do the things that are necessary to put in place the proper infrastructure to make our country operate properly. It is left to the whims of politicians to decide on a clip of a finger as to when, how, where they want to do whatever. We can't continually operate like that. Some of you may not see it, but in my eyes, in terms of how I see the Bahamas, we are slipping. We need to begin doing some things to put our footing on a more solid foundation to go forward. This agreement doesn't solve all of our problems, but guess what? It helps the process one step at a time. We have improvement in measures and so forth. And as I said earlier, compliance with WTO agreement is a part of that. The other areas of the agreement has the investment schedule, which talks about the other service sector. I'm not talking about forestry and hunting and fishing and mining, but that's covered in the agreement. And then there's the service schedule that I'm going to talk a little bit about. It covers some 155 sectors. In other words, as a part of this agreement, they've identified 155 sectors that all countries that participate in this agreement must speak to the liberalization of those 155 sectors. Okay? In the case of the Bahamas, we have to meet 75%. We must demonstrate some degree of liberalization in 75% of 155 sectors, which approximate 120. Okay? E-commerce. That's about it. The trade-related issues, I think I talked about them, competition, innovation, you know, these are part of the agreement. And all of these has different time frame as to when we need to have it in place. Like, for example, competition laws. There's a time frame. I'm not sure whether it's 3 or 5 years, but it's not more than 7, but it's somewhere within 3 to 7 years that we need to have the competition laws in place. And all of these have some kind of general time frame to give you an opportunity to come up to the plate to begin putting these things in place. Now, one of the things that I think is critical for your understanding of this agreement, because I think it makes no sense you debating or discussing any aspect of this agreement without you having some level of appreciation for the horizontal commitments. What do I mean when I say horizontal commitment? Well, each country has an opportunity to say what concerns from an overall basis as to what they are prepared to do. What are the major concerns in the Bahamas? Immigration, exchange control policies, investment policies. You know, those things are important to the Bahamas. And so, whatever we do, we want those situations to be subject to our rules in immigration, our rules in exchange control, and investment. What do I mean? The government will attempt. Whether or not they will be successful, I am not sure, because, you know, most of what we currently have now are policies. We don't have laws. Like I said earlier, you know, the guys meet around the table and they decide. So if they had a good weekend, they may go left. If they didn't have a good weekend, they may go right. So we have policies, okay? Now, so that does raise a question. So we have policies around some of these issues. Clearly, we would have to make those policies laws. For example, in our investment policies, we have requirement for all business that must be owned by Bahamians. For example, all retail and wholesale operation. Not on the table. So let's not discuss it. Not to be discussed. It's not on the table. All these people complaining about retail, the government has said that is exclusively Bahamian. Now, but guess what? You know and I know, not only Bahamians own retail and wholesale. Why has that happened? Even though we've had a policy all these years that says only Bahamian on it. Well, you know why? A group of guys met around the table and decided they don't mind letting this one in and that one in. So they decided when they were going to violate the policy, when they were not going to violate the policy. Okay? That's why we have some foreign. And so it's not a matter of all. It's a matter of who they want it to be. The day they decide it's Winn-Dixie. The more they may decide it's a company, Clico. They may decide it's Sagicor. Yeah, just a couple of years ago, they decided it was Sagicor. Yeah, they just decide which one they like, you know, toss of a coin. That's not the way you operate, that's not the way you should be operating the country. But that's what we do. But the point is, we have those policies in place. And if we liberalize any service sector, those policies must be adhered to. And that's why they're called horizontal commitment. For example, if we open up the accounting profession, whatever happens in the accounting profession must be subject to those horizontal policies. What are our immigration policy? What are our exchange control policy? What are our investment policy and so on? Okay? If we open up advertising services, those advertising services must be subject to exchange control, immigration, and investment. In other words, if only Bahamas is in a certain category, that's it. You can liberalize it as much as you want to. The horizontal commitment says only Bahamas are going to be in this category. So it's important for you to understand that. And it's important for you, when you finally see this agreement, to say to yourself, what are the final horizontal commitments? Because that determines at the end of the day the baseline as to who has been exposed from a liberalization point of view. Okay? Then we have, once you get below the horizontal commitment, we have what we call sector-specific commitments. Okay? And this is where we talk about restrictions, market access. In other words, in the field of accounting, who are we going to allow to have access to our accounting profession? You know, are we going to allow some or are we not going to allow any? But that's where we talk about that. National treatment. Once they come to the Bahamas, are they going to be treated the same as the domestic players? Remember, the way how they're going to be treated, whether or not they're Bahamian or foreigner, is going to be dictated already by the horizontal commitment. So even if I liberalize something, if it doesn't meet the horizontal commitment, then it's a no-go, okay? description of the service. And that's just the terminology used in world trading to talk about that. Next slide. And these, some of you all know, these are the mode of services, how services delivered around the world. Cross-border, like telex and computers. In other words, you don't have to be in a country to provide service. You just send a telex. Maybe you send a fax. Okay? Consumption abroad. In other words, you go to another country to provide service on maybe a piece of asset that you have, a boat, plane, okay? Or you go there to consume as a tourist. Your consumption, that's a mode of service, okay? And these are important because guess what? We're going to talk about later in terms of, because these are the different types of services that you either open or close, okay? Commercial presence, the always big one concern for behemoths. Who's going to be able to set up shop here? That's the big one. And then obviously the next big one is once they set up shop here, are we going to allow influx of people and to what extent, okay? And if you get a copy of this agreement, and the government will be making it available to you sometime soon after it's been finalized, you would run across these terms in each one of those sectors. The sector side is open. In other words, when you see the word none, that means we have no restriction. It's open. But guess what I said? Remember, it's open, but it is still subject to the horizontal commitment. It's still got to meet those rules, even though we decide to open it. Okay? Or you're going to see a term unbound. That means it's closed. Or you may say it's unbound for the next 5 years. Or it's unbound in regard to certain aspect of it. So, you know, those are the kinds of things you're going to see in the agreement when it's completed. And this is the area. Now, remember I said that 122 services have to be opened up, liberalized to some degree. However, not all aspects of the mode of service needs to be open. Just 1 out of 8. Has to be open, and you have met the requirement. For example, let's take my field as accountants. If I say it's okay for individuals to perform accounting services on financial statements outside of the Bahamas, I'm prepared to open it up. Okay, then I've met the liberalization for accounting. I don't have to say nothing to talk about it anymore. I'm not talking about accountants coming here or accountants setting up business here, and so that's no longer an issue. I have met the requirement of opening that particular service up, line open. Okay, so remember you have 1 out of 8 opportunities to open. Okay, and when you go to every sector, they'll have those, it would say as to how we have dealt with those 8 categories. Remember those 1, 2, 3, 4 refers to the mode of service delivery, and then the top talks about the limitation in terms of who's gonna have market access and the limitation in terms of how we're gonna treat them as behemoths. What does it mean to the Bahamas? The partnership agreement, we all know, is between the European and CARIFORM. Now, it's very important to understand that this is not an agreement of CARIFORM among itself. In other words, some people talk about CSME and backdoor and that kind of stuff. You know, let's be reasonable and let's use common sense here. Europe is not going to open up their borders for the people from the Caribbean to move in and out as they like. That's not going to happen. Okay? So don't put that as a part of the agreement because that ain't happening. That ain't going to happen. It's as simple as that. Okay? We talk about some of the aspect in terms of it seeks to expand opportunities and make things better. I mean, sometimes it does, sometimes it don't, but that's the objective. Okay? Duty-free access of goods. We all know about the profit situation. But you know, we here in the Bahamas, we are always playing catch-up. We're always playing catch-up. That's what this is all about, catch-up. You know? Now some may say, well, the crawfish industry is a very small part of the trade in goods and is only $10-20 million, and so why should we go through this for the crawfish? But folks, we're not just thinking about the situation today. I don't know what's going to happen. I'm hoping that Freeport can finally open up. And if Freeport does open up, I would hate to know that Freeport doesn't have access to the European community. So I'm thinking futuristic too. I'm not saying, well, today only $20 million of my billion-dollar, you know, revenue is being determined. But guess what? I want Freeport to be in a position when it's open up that they don't have to worry about it. I don't want them to be locked up. Okay? Rights to service providers. Technical assistance. I mean, these are some of the things you're always going to see in some of these agreements between smaller countries and larger countries. We talked about that. We talked about the 25-year period. Here again, you know, some people may say, well, the Bahamas doesn't have anything to sell with Europe in terms of services. Folks, this is not about how you see the world today. This is creating an opportunity so the world is at least available to you if you decide to do certain things. So don't just see this as, what's the impact today? Try to see the big picture. And the big picture is trying to lay the framework for a bigger situation. You know, they talk about junkanoo groups and so forth, some aspect of it. You know, that's a cultural aspect that we would like to have exported more to Europe. That's available. Here at the bottom, in terms of, obviously, we're going to have some movement of people. I would not be telling you the truth that there won't be some movement of people, okay? But there will not be any permanent movement of people, okay? And remember, movement of people will still be subject to that horizontal commitment called immigration policies, okay? 3 years max, individual, in terms of having a right to come to work to the Bahamas. That happens now. Anyone who has an operation in the Bahamas can come after a period of time, okay? So that's nothing new. An individual who has been granted the right to provide service in the Bahamas, in other words, the government of the Bahamas gave you a contract to provide certain service, you need access to come to the Bahamas to work. The agreement allows for that to happen. These are all what we call temporary movement of people, okay? And the way I look at it, these things are happening now. I don't see those as major burdensome. I see those as opportunity for behemoths. See, behemoths always think one-sided. The world has always been open to behemoths. The world has never treated the Bahamas the way the Bahamas wants to treat the world sometimes. In other words, the world has never told the Bahamas, but guess what, behemoths? When you come to the United States and get an education, you cannot work here. You know how many behemoths, you know, working with Deloitte & Touche in the United States that I had nothing to do with? You know, they just happen to be good at what they do, and guess what? They have a job there, okay? The world don't treat us like that. Obviously, the world don't understand we're a small country, so we can't do all the things that they do. But clearly, it's coming a point in time where we got to be big boys too, and we're going to play by this rule, and guess what? You know, when big countries start stepping on us and start treating us the way we treat them, it's not going to be a good day because we're not going to have anything to stand on. So at some point in time, we're going to have to begin to open up this process and to begin to allow certain things to happen, okay? This here, again, this just talks about different types of technical assistance and so forth. Go to the next slide. I talked about the transparency in government. I don't think I need to talk about that more in terms of how government does things and the ability for this agreement to bring a little bit more structure to the overall process. We talked about patents and trademarks and so on. Competition policy, custom modernization, we talked about that. Point of reference in terms of international investor, you know, here again, as I said earlier, if someone asks you, what do you need to come and invest in the Bahamas? None of us could really tell them precisely what it is. It's always subject to somebody's whims. We need to change that. Okay, we've gotten away with it, but you know, you can't. What are some of the challenges? Reorienting the private sector to think about opportunities if this is available. What are some of the things we can do? As I said earlier, some of you may not believe it, but in my eyes, we're losing ground. It may be slow, but we're losing ground. And we gotta reorient it. We gotta do some things different. And we got to create some opportunities, okay? Improving the regulatory system. Here again, it's a term on in terms of custom reform. They need about 3 years to get their act together. And I want to say just one more thing before I go. You know, I've looked at Barbados trade agreement, you know, and I don't know how many of you think about Barbados, but Barbados is on the roll as a country. Clear vision as to where they want. They're not reacting like we are. Clear vision as to where they want to go, clear vision as to what they want to liberalize. When you look at some of the things that Barbados is liberalizing, and you look at the gripes of behemoths, I'll give you an example, accounting field. The Barbadians are prepared to open up their accounting profession. Now, all accountants in Barbados may not have a problem with that, but the government has reached a point and the majority of the people are saying, look, we are prepared to open up the accounting profession to allow non-Barbadian accountants to come to Barbados to work on non-Barbadian accounts. See, Barbados has created a world of mushroom for international trade, and now they are in a position to allow accountants to come in to work on those assignments. The same with lawyers. Barbados is prepared to allow foreign lawyers to come into Barbados and provide services to non-Barbadian companies. Major step. You know, we in the Bahamas like to think that we're the king of the hill, but guess what? We're not. The rest of the world has a far better vision and is in a far better position and prepared to do some things that we aren't prepared to do. When I talked to my colleagues in accounting, I said, look, we don't need to fear anything in accounting. We are a global profession. We train and we develop in the USA, okay? We can go anywhere in the world. We are global players. There's no need to fear anything. No one coming in the Bahamas can come with greater status. We have the status. So let's give a little and take. Thanks very much.
Well, thank you very much, Ray. Very stimulating. I'm sure there'll be questions afterwards. It's now Brian's turn to maybe give a slightly contrary view.
Thank you very much, Peter. Good evening. I'm very grateful to have the opportunity to share some thoughts with you about a subject which I think is extremely important. And I applaud the Nassau Institute for providing these opportunities for civil society to be engaged in a thoughtful and hopefully useful public dialogue about an issue which I think has great ramifications, not only for ourselves, but for generations that follow. I would just like to say, before turning to my slide presentation, that a number of things which Ray said, I'm tempted to respond to, but I'm going to keep them for the Q&A, I think. But I do want to say this. He talks about looking to the future, and I agree with that, and not only assessing what our position should be on the EPA and similar FTAs in the context of where we are now, but where we will be perhaps 10, 15, 20 years from now. I would only suggest this in that same context. Those of you who are familiar with the EU will remember that when it started, it looked like a fairly tame animal, and nobody 25, 30 years ago would have believed that today in 2008, the EU would be where it is today, basically with a supranational government in Brussels, basically exercising sovereignty over 27 different countries on many domestic policy issues, and has a budget which far exceeds the budgets of most national governments. It is a massive bureaucracy. And one of the very real concerns that I have is not necessarily where we are today and where we are starting today, but what we are committing to as a process and what is the inevitable consequence of that process in the fullness of time. For people to say, worry about what's going to happen 10 years or 15 or 20 years from now, I'm not concerned about it. Well, I don't have that luxury because I have children, and I'm sure most of you have children. I'm not simply concerned about where we are today. I'm concerned about joining a process which is only headed in one direction. And on this, there can be absolutely no reasonable disagreement. And I don't wish to be that dogmatic about many things, but I can be dogmatic about this. Because for any of you who wish to hear, you don't want to hear it, then you won't hear it. But all you have to do is an hour's worth of research on the internet and go and see what is being said about the EPA process, not only around the region, but around the world. See what is driving that process. See where it is headed. And I will try to share some of those thoughts with you in a moment. And then let us see whether, as a country, we want to go in the direction where the EPA is going. If we do, then there's no problem. we should get on board and we should try to do the best we can in negotiations to protect our interests. But there may be a large number of us who do not believe that the inevitable destination of the EPA is a place where we necessarily want to be. Now, having said that, I thought I would just use my introductory remarks, not by taking you through a rather dry and boring review of the actual provisions of the agreement, and we may get into some of that during the Q&A, but I thought I'd try to give you a flavor of the process and what is being said about persons who are intimately involved in the process, to give you some context. You know, I'm not a proponent, nor am I an opponent of the EPA. Right? I think my role, really, as a member of civil society, is just to try and disseminate good quality information and promote thoughtful, rational, objective discourse. And then people can make up their own mind. But in order to do that, you need a bit of context. All right, and sometimes we live in an insular world here, and so we don't really know what has been going on. So I'm going to try and give you a little walkthrough, right, by reference to quotes and statements made by persons who have been intimately involved in the negotiations and the process, so you can get an idea as to how we got to where we are. All right, now, this is a matter of history. On December the 27th, there was a signing of the Economic Partnership Agreement. You might just be interested to see the countries which comprise CARIFORA. Many of you will know those countries now. But there are 14 countries, and they are listed there for you. Antigua and Barbuda, Bahamas, Barbados, Belize, the Dominican Republic, Grenada, Guyana, Haiti, Jamaica, St. Lucia, St. Vincent and the Grenadines, St. Kitts and Nevis, Suriname, and Trinidad and Tobago. So those were our negotiating partners with regard to this arrangement. The next slide says that the Caribbean is the only region in the ACP that initialed a full EPA with the European Union by the deadline, the 31st of December, the date of expiry of the waiver covering the Cotonou trade preferences. Trade in goods is the only key area that needed to be covered by an agreement to comply with WTO rules. I want to make 2 points here. All right, you know, you had a lot of people going around this country saying, the end of last year, you know, was a drop-dead date. We had to have something by the end of last year. If we didn't have something in place by the end of last year, then we would be faced with tariffs and all sorts of import duties. We had to sign the EPA. Well, you know what? Interestingly enough, we are the only region within the six regions in the ACP which actually signed a full EPA by the end of last year. The other five regions have not. Secondly, you have heard many people say, the EU would never negotiate with countries. They want no bilateral arrangements. They want to deal with blocs. Well, you know, guess what? Look at what has happened in Africa. You'll see in a moment from a slide which I will give you. In many instances in the other regions, the EU took what they could get, which was an interim EPA, dealing with goods only, nothing to do with services, nothing to do with investments. And they were prepared to have bilateral interim EPAs so that they could work on bloc or regional EPAs throughout 2008. And now they are saying that basically the rest of this year will be given to trying to finalize the permanent full EPAs with these different regions. You know, it's all a matter of good quality information. The fact of the matter is, and you heard many people say, we had to do the EPA because of the WTO, the expiration of the WTO waiver with regard to the preferences that we were getting from the EU, which were not reciprocated. Well, again, that is true. But only the goods services agree, only the goods submission was necessary under the WTO rules. You will see that in our EPA, we deal with a whole range of other issues. Ray went through them. Current payments, social, cultural, services, investment. None of those matters or subjects were required to be in the EPA by the WTO. The only provision that we had to cover in order to maintain our access to the European markets from the point of view of WTO rules was the goods part of this agreement. As Ray said, That was the less controversial part. It was signed before anybody in the Bahamas knew anything about it. I'm talking about the ordinary people. I guess the government knew about it. That was squared away last year before there was virtually any discussion on it at all. And I heard Ray say that the government will make available a copy of the agreement after it is finalized. Well, I don't know if that is the policy of the government, but I would suggest respectfully that it would be very helpful for them to make available copies of the agreement before it is finalized. If they wish to have an intelligent discourse with civil society, it would be useful for us to have access to the annex and to have access to the agreement. Now, I have the agreement because I got it off the internet. I don't know if it's the final one. I don't know what the government has done. But this comes back to the flow of information. It is impossible for civil society to be actively engaged in this process in a responsible way unless it is provided with timely information about the EPA and about specifically the annex which is being worked on in respect of the services submission. So you'll see that the EPA is like a new economic constitution regulating many aspects of our external and domestic policy. I want to give you an idea. For the next several slides, you are going to see quotes from negotiators who were part of the CARIFORUM team and from politicians within the Caribbean. All right? And I wanted to give you a flavor of whether the EPA is important for us. You know, is it something which deserves your time and attention by being here this evening? You're indicating an interest. Just how important is the EPA? Well, I wanted to give you not my view of this. I wanted to give you a sense of the view of the persons who are intimately involved in the process so you understand just how important this EPA is. The first quote, which came from a politician, is the one that we just read, which basically likened the EPA to a constitution. Now, for those of you who know anything about a constitution, you will appreciate the importance of it. This is not just another agreement. Next slide, please, Rick. Another official said the EPA is a treaty that is legally binding, of indefinite duration, will be very difficult to amend once it is in force, covers a wide range of subject areas that have hitherto been within the jurisdiction of domestic or regional policy, and which few people know about and even less understand. That is a quote by one of the principal negotiators, right, of the EPA. All right, next slide. By its terms, the CARIFORUM EPA aims at achieving sustainable development by establishing a trade partnership which promotes regional integration. I want to come back to that in a moment, regional integration. And the gradual integration of CARIFORUM countries into the world economy. Next slide. The institutional requirements for EPA implement, these are all quotes from senior officials. The institutional requirements for EPA implementation and governance are huge and will be demanding on the scarce money and manpower of CARIFORUM states. Also, they endow joint committees set up with the Europeans and the Dominican Republic with considerable powers. CARIFORUM states will have veto powers, but the EC will hold the upper hand because of the leverage of market access and development assistance. The powers may supersede CARICOM's own organs of governance. Now, here, I just want to alert you that as you review the material, as you follow the developments, just keep your eye on the supranational elements of the process. I guarantee you they will be there, all right? They won't jump out of you because it is an incremental process. But here is one of the negotiators himself saying that some of these new committees which are being formed under the EPA may well have more power in respect of CARICOM than the organs of CARICOM itself. Next slide. The CARIFORUM EC Economic Partnership Agreement is more than just a trade agreement. Its scope embraces many subjects that have up to now been solely or mainly within national and regional jurisdiction. Note that. As a legally binding international instrument with elaborate implementation and enforcement provisions, it embodies a far higher degree of supranational governance than the corresponding arrangements in the Caribbean community. When we talk about supranational governance, that simply means you have a power base which has the ability to legislate and make decisions for national countries. So their power is supra to our own national government. All right? This is the same man He continues, the EPA will inevitably condition the scope and content of future agreements made between CARICOM and other major trading partners and the region's stance in WTO negotiations. There is a sense, therefore, in which the EPA sets up a framework for the future evolution of the economic, social, and environmental policies of CARICOM states, both separately and collectively, and for the terms on which the region engages with the global community. This is a very well-known man, Norman Gervin, in the Caribbean, who is an admitted expert on free trade. Next slide.
Yep.
Now, it was not necessary for these subjects to be included in the EPA in order for it to be WT compatible as required by the Cotonou Agreement. However, Europe pushed for the inclusion of these subjects in EPAs mainly because they provide additional protection and opportunities for EU firms and investors. That's the simple point, that the vast majority of the material and subjects which are covered by our EPA were not necessary in order to make it WTO compliant. All right, let's go to the next slide. The inclusion of WTO plus commitments in the EPA in services, intellectual property competition, public procurement, investment, and e-commerce was not necessary to secure the approval of the EPA under WTO rules, which require only WTO compatibility. They will require CARIFORM states to adopt legislation, regulations, practices, and policies that will be onerous in terms of money and scarce technical manpower. The costs of compliance have yet to be quantified. Next slide. The CARIFORM EPA also provides for heightened intellectual property protection that goes way beyond what's called the TRIPS, the Trade-Related Intellectual Property Rights Agreement in the WTO. Other subjects that are not within the scope of the current WTO agreements are current account payments, environment, social aspects, and cultural cooperation. The point I'm simply trying to make for you is not that these are necessarily bad things to have in the agreement. My point is they were not necessary in order to satisfy the WTO. That's the point. So when people say this is a WTO-driven exercise, that is only partially true. What was WTO-driven was the goods side of the exercise. The waiver in respect of the non-reciprocal preferences which the EU had given to CARIFORM countries under the Cotonou Agreement were going to expire at the end of last year. And it was necessary to put something in place. Many of the African countries, which did not sign EPAs, ended up getting the benefit of something called Everything But Arms, EBA arrangements, and we don't have time to go into that. But the point is, we have gone way beyond what we had to do for WTO. Next slide. CARIFORM could have negotiated an EPA limited to what was necessary for compatibility. An inclusion of the WTO plus areas in services, competition, public procurement, and investment could have been deferred pending WTO agreement in these areas. All right, so what we have done is we are ahead of the pack. I'm not sure that's where you want to be in this exercise. All right, because you know the world changes very quickly. Only a month from now, in July, the French president assumes the chairmanship of the EU for 6 months. If you look at his pronouncements about EPAs generally, and he's appointed one of his ministers to do a review of the EPAs, the interim EPAs, and where that position stands with regard primarily to the African-based countries. There is every reason to believe from his public statements that he is going to take a less demanding position with regard to some of the concessions that Mandelson was insisting that the CARIFORM countries accept at the end of last year. Right? So, you know, the world changes. The French president has a different view based upon many of his public statements. And consequently, I am not sure we want to be ahead of everybody else in these areas. All right, let's go to the next slide. These are just the six regions now. I'm going to take a quick look at where they stand. West Africa, Central Africa, East South Africa, Southern Africa, the Caribbean, and the Pacific. Remember, we're the only one that signed the full EPA by the end of last year. In the Pacific, Fiji and Papua New Guinea have initialed an interim EPA. In Africa, Comoros, Madagascar, Seychelles, Zimbabwe, Malawi, and Mauritius have all initialed as individual countries. In Central Africa, the only country to initial an interim EPA is Cameroon. In West Africa, only the Ivory Coast and Ghana made last-minute details to initial interim EPAs. All right, next slide. Many African countries successfully registered EU pressure, resisted EU pressure to enter into full EPAs. This was during the last 2 or 3 months of last year. Less than half of the eligible African countries entered into interim EPAs, which do not go beyond products to include services and trade facilitation. 42 ACP states or countries have not yet initialed an agreement. All right, and then this last point is the very point I made about the French president taking over, and that he's indicated that he will relax the demands. Now, I want you to understand, these are not my thoughts. Right? These are thoughts that come out of public statements made by persons directly involved in the process and by senior politicians, prime ministers, presidents, the secretary general. I hope it begins to give you a flavor of what we're dealing with. Next slide. To date, and I've said this, we're the only region that signed the full EPA. Next slide, please. All right, I want to talk briefly. I know, Peter, we're running out of time for Q&A. I want to talk briefly about regional integration. And this, I think, is a very important point. All right, I'm not here to suggest to you that the objective of regional integration from the point of view of the Bahamas is a good thing or a bad thing. That is not my role, and I'm not interested in telling you what you should think about that. What I am interested in letting you know, right, is that regional integration is the single largest motivating factor behind the EPA, as it was behind the CSMNE. And by making that comparison, I'm not suggesting they are the same. I agree with Ray. CSMNE is a different subject altogether than the EPA. But make no mistake about it, right? What is driving major components of the EPA is a commitment to regional integration between the CARIFORM countries. Now, if we had time, I would pause here to say, how many of you really understand what that term means? What is regional integration? All right, we may get to that in the Q&A, but I'll tell you this. You cannot talk about the EPA with the EU without talking about regional integration, because if we as a country decide that that is not in our national interests, regional integration, then we should be exceedingly careful about ratifying this EPA. Because I'm going to show you in a moment, in just 3 minutes, I hope, how regional integration permeates virtually every chapter of the agreement. And that is the driving force, because the EU is firmly committed to that concept. They themselves had regional integration within Europe. That is what they would wish to impose upon all of the regions within the ACP. It also makes life much easier if they can negotiate as a bloc than if they have to negotiate with scores of individual countries. Right, next slide. Just go back one slide for me, Rick. I want you to note this comment of the Prime Minister of Jamaica. He said that if carefully managed, the implementation of the EPA can actually serve as a stimulus for the region to finally conclude some of the long outstanding projects on its integration agenda. Jamaica is one of the leading proponents of regional integration within the region. This is a desirable objective. Now, from the point of view of the Bahamas, it may or it may not be, but we should not make that decision by omission. We should make it deliberately, knowing that that's where this is all going. Next slide, please. Now, I'm just going to give you now quickly a number of provisions which come right out of the EPA. These are not summaries, and I've highlighted in red everywhere you see the term regional integration. The first one is in the recitals, where it says that this is right in the front of the agreement. It says, reaffirming their commitment to support the regional integration process among CARIFORM states. Let's go to the next slide. Under Article 1, it says, one of the objectives of the EPA, promoting regional integration, economic cooperation, and good governance. Next slide, please. Article 4, the parties recognize that regional integration is an integral element to their partnership and a powerful instrument to achieve the objectives. Clause 2, the parties recognize, now the parties means the signatories. That's the CARIFORM states and the member states of the EU. That's the Bahamas, if we sign. We recognize and reaffirm the importance of regional integration among the CARIFORM states. as a mechanism for enabling these states to achieve greater economic opportunities. Next slide. The parties acknowledge the efforts of the CARIFORM states to foster regional and sub-regional integration amongst themselves through the revised Treaty of Chagaramas, That, of course, is the treaty under which the CSMNE was set up. Next slide. Now, this is an important article. This is the article which many of my friends who have a different view about this point me to and say, yeah, you're right to say regional integration is all the way through the agreement, but look at Article 4, all right? And they take solace in the fact that Article 4 has this provision. The parties, that's the countries, the member states, further recognize that without prejudice to the commitments undertaken in this agreement, the pace and content of regional integration is a matter to be determined exclusively by the CARIFORM states in the exercise of their sovereignty and given their current and future political ambitions. So it has to be acknowledged that there is that provision. Now, what we have to decide is, given that provision and given everything else that we see in the agreement and given what we know about the agreement, whether really it is realistic for the Bahamas to hypothetically take this position. Suppose we say, and I'm not, as I say, advocating this, I'm just putting this out hypothetically. I'm just postulating this scenario. Suppose the Bahamas says, you know, our future and national interests are more connected to the U.S. than they are connected to the South of the Caribbean. Ex hypothesi. All right? That being the case, we really do not see full regional integration at the economic level and the political level and the social level and the cultural level and the environmental level as an objective which is compatible with our national interests. Yet, we're going to sign this EPA, right, which is predicated very substantially on achieving a common goal that all of the signatory states are reaffirming, and that is the commitment to achieve regional integration. My point of view is it doesn't make any sense, right? It makes a lot of sense to sign the EPA if we agree with regional integration and if we see that as our future. If we don't see it as our future, I think we need to think again. Next slide, please. Article 34, the party shall promote to the fullest extent possible regional integration. Next slide. Article 38, the parties recognize that the integration of the agriculture, food, and fishery sectors across CARIFORM states through the progressive removal of remaining barriers and the provision of an appropriate regulatory framework will contribute what? To the deepening of the regional integration process. Next slide. That's the next one. Will you see the same in red again? Deepening of the regional integration process. Next slide. All right, now, I didn't give you all the provisions. That's just a sampling of the provisions dealing with regional integration. The EPA provisions establish a dangerous precedent for upcoming trade agreements to be negotiated with the U.S. and Canada. Very quickly, and I'll only be 3 minutes on this, this is one of my other concerns, that in signing the EPA with the EU, we are sealing our fate, right, with the U.S. Right now, we have the benefits of the CBI, which is not reciprocal. It's the old-fashioned agreement like the Cotonou Agreement. Under the CBI, we have access to U.S. markets at preferential and preferential terms without giving them access to our markets. All right? That is an oversimplification, but that is not inaccurate in terms of where we stand with the CBI. Now, I ask you, as sensible members of civil society, do you think that when the Americans come to talk to us, they're going to accept the fact that we have signed an EPA with the EU, which is fully reciprocal? Every concession, well, that's probably not fair. There's some asymmetry in the EPA, but to a large extent, the preferences which are given, the access to markets which are given under the EPA are fully reciprocal, unlike the Cotonou Agreement. So if we're going to get access to the EU markets duty-free, they're going to have to get access to our markets. And you put together with that something which is known as the most favored nation provision, right, in this EPA, which says that whenever we do another agreement, an FTA or a trade agreement, with another major player, to the extent that it is better than what we've given the EU and the EPA, the EU must be given those additional concessions. All right, and vice versa. Right? And also remember that these provisions don't only flow between the EU and the CARIFORM states, they also flow between the individual CARIFORM states. So this applies as much to the Bahamas and Jamaica and Trinidad and Barbados as it does to Luxembourg, you know, or France and the Bahamas. All right? It's fully reciprocal within the CARIFORM group of companies themselves. So do you think that the U.S. are going to accept a position where they give us a one-way street, access to their markets, while we are giving the EU a two-way street, right? It doesn't make any sense at all. And what it means is that CBI is over for CARICOM, all right? It will be very difficult to see how we will be able to maintain, for any significant period of time, the approach under the CBI, the Caribbean Basin Initiative. Next slide, please. I say that before we ratify the EPA, we should seriously review its implications for the U.S.-Bahamas trade relations, right? Bearing in mind that the most important trading partnership or arrangement for the Bahamas is with the U.S., bar none, all right? And I think we all would accept that fact. Our single largest trading partner is the U.S. It is the most important trading partner that we have in the world. Next slide, please. Stephen Land, who many of you may have heard about, he was a major player in the CBI initiative. He's now a consultant. This is what he said about the EPA and its effect on our discussions with the Americans. This is a former employee of the Office of U.S. Trade Representatives who represented America, the American government, in the CBI initiative. He said, CARICOM appears to be sacrificing any possibility of continuing benefits under the U.S. Caribbean Basin Initiative by rushing into full economic partnership agreements with the EU. Given the complexities that have arisen since the conclusion of the negotiations, a delay in finalizing the EPAs would be prudent. If the agreements are implemented before these issues have been resolved, CARICOM may find itself losing preferential access into the U.S., the major market of the Caribbean, in order to come to an agreement with the EU, a secondary trading partner. I don't think it could be put any clearer than that. Next slide. Right? Signing and ratifying the EU and the EPA, which replaces unilateral preferences, creates several problems. Now, I want to flick through this quickly because we're running out of time. But there were three basic problems I saw. But let's go through that slide, through the next one, Rick. Through the next one, through the next one. All right. Just in case you need to be reminded, all right, the Bahamas is home to 30,000 Americans, about 110 U.S.-based businesses. About 87% of our tourists come from the U.S. Let's go to the next slide. Let's look at trade. In 2005, you'll see that our exports, almost 67% of our exports went to the U.S. Our imports, right, 84%, right, from the U.S. This is really a non-brainer. It is very, very clear that the most important trading relationship that we will have to attend to is that with the United States. Yet, we are now handcuffing our negotiators as we will have to go into these negotiations over the next several years. Next slide. Next slide, please. Next slide. I think we're gonna skip through all of this, Rick. Let's go back. Keep going, keep going, keep going. Well, hold on a second. Go back one slide, one more slide. Yeah, I want to give you this quote, all right? This is the former Minister of Foreign Affairs and Foreign Trade of Jamaica. He led the CARIFORM negotiations back in 2004, I think it was, right? He was a major player. Listen to what he said in October. This is when we were coming up to the deadline and the EU was putting maximum pressure on the parties to finalize it. He said, "It is clear that the negotiations are balanced on a knife's edge, and much is at stake for the CARIFORM countries. It is possible for the EU to either pull the knife and slice and dice the CARIFORM countries, or work with the CARIFORM countries to broaden the knife's edge and create a platform for genuine development of the CARIFORM countries." Next slide. "We remind CARIFORM leaders," this is still the Jamaican former minister speaking, "we remind CARIFORM leaders that there is indeed a fine line between murder and suicide, but they should resolve never to let murder pass for suicide." I couldn't have put it any better myself, right? Only a Jamaican could put it so well, right? I mean, we should take heed. This is a man that knows what he's talking about. Next slide. we saw in late last year all sorts of things happening. If you know exactly, this is a question where, you know, what's that story about the sausage? You don't want to know how it's made. You just want to buy it in the food store and eat it. Next slide. All right. The last-minute agreement did not leave sufficient time for national leaders and the political arm of CARICOM to grasp all the complexities. That's not my view. Right? That is a view that came off the webpage of CARICOM. Right? Listen to what Mr. Anthony Hilton, this is the same minister, what he said in October last year. In international negotiations, countries must ensure that they deploy the resources and take the time necessary to secure their vital interests. Mr. Hilton stated that the European Trade Commissioner, Peter Mandelson, had threatened that unless an agreement was in place by December, the European Commission would unilaterally impose tariffs on all previously tariff-free Caribbean exports to Europe. By issuing the not-so-subtle threat, Europe required the Caribbean to sacrifice its vital interests. It is this kind of imbalance which has bedeviled the EPA process since the conclusion of the Cotonou Agreement. That is not my view. Right? That is the view of the Minister of Trade for Jamaica, who was a senior negotiator at the beginning of the CARICOM process. He continued, the non-reciprocity in the Lome 1 Convention was not given, it was negotiated. The trade component of the Lome 1 Convention was hailed universally as a model for trade agreements between developed and developing countries and Europe as a pioneer and trailblazer. To threaten to unilaterally abrogate this agreement is an indication of how far Europe has retrogressed in its support for real development. All right, interesting. Next slide, please. Right? At the end of 2007, the EU commissioner, that's Mandelson, sought to extract political agreements under the sword of the imposition of tariffs. Go to the next slide. Look at what the ACP Council of Ministers stated in December. All right? They deplored the enormous pressure that has been brought to bear on the ACP states by the European Commission to initial the interim trade agreements. The ACP Secretary General characterized the process as fraught with panic, confusion, and disagreements. That's the mood which existed towards the end of last year, right? Now, I'll go through this quickly. We'll come back to this if you want to look at it. National treatment, we don't have time to deal with that at the moment. Keep going, Rick. Hold on. Keep going, please. Keep going. Okay, go back one slide, please, right? Go back one slide. Okay, sorry, forward one. I want to leave you with this. You know, this may sound familiar to some of you, but it's what happened with regard to Europe. In the EC debate, which occurred in Europe some time ago, the benefits of membership of the community became an article of faith which no rational person could question. In the worlds of politics, the media, and big business, acceptance of Europe had become an unchallenged orthodoxy. So that any distress of the political Europe could be portrayed as xenophobic hostility to everything stood for by the wider geographical Europe with all its diverse people and cultures. Just go to the next slide. To support the project, which was the EC at that time, was seen as pro-European, implying that this meant outward-looking, positive internationalists, progressive on the side of the future. Any anti-European sentiments were labeled as inward-looking, negative, narrowly nationalistic, fearful of change, belonging to the past. Now, I don't know if some of you remember this debate, but I myself have been the subject of many of those criticisms, being xenophobic, being nationalistic, being negative, not being open-minded, simply because, right, I express a view which is not consistent with the orthodoxy. And I only put it up here to remind you, don't let's opt out of this process, right, simply because there is an establishment that is seeking to demonize any opposition. Right? The fact of the matter is, there is no high ground in this debate. All right, there is none. This is a messy process. I'll leave you with two quotes. Next slide. Margaret Thatcher put this in her memoirs. She said, it is one of the great weaknesses of reasonable men and women that they imagine the projects which fly in the face of common sense are not serious or being serious or being serious are not serious or being seriously undertaking. In other words, because we think something is so far-fetched, right, we think it's not serious. So we don't really get too concerned about it. All right? And that is the point she made about Europe. And the last point I'd leave you with is this. You know, everybody says, we have no options. We have no options. Well, the belief that we do not have choices is a fantasy, an unfortunate indulgence and abdication. That was written in a book called The Collapse of Globalization. So I leave you with the view that it is not my role or Ray's role to tell you whether the EPA is a good thing or a bad thing, right? All I tried to do tonight, and taken up probably more time than Peter wanted me to, but I only did it because Ray did it, right? Was to try to give you the other side, just a glimpse into the process, so you have some context, all right? So you understand, you know, that this whole process is fraught with difficulties, legitimate questions, and our role as responsible citizens, you know, is to try and get good quality information, promote public discourse, and then make our views known to the political directorate, right? So we can try to protect the interests for ourselves and our children. Thank you.